humans made her so angry. When she reached the lodge, she perched on a railing for a moment before hopping down to the deck and shifting to her human form. Then she turned and stared at the Jumbles beach on the other side of the lake.
"Since Miss Vicky has human guests, and you look human, you might want to put some clothes on so they don't see more than they're used to seeing,"
Ilya Sanguinati said, as he stepped out of the lodge and joined her on the deck.
"Not that they could see this far across the lake without binoculars, but humans often carry such things when they're in the wild country. Or so I've been told."
Aggie turned to face the vampire, whose lips were curved in a hint of a smile. "If the Crowguard peck out their eyes, they won't see anything." The smile faded.
"What happened?"
"They were mean to Miss Vicky. They made her cry."
No amusement now. Ilya stared across the lake, then took a seat in one of the chairs.
"Tell me."
Aggie and Miss Vicky watched three shiny cars drive up to the main house. At least, she thought they were cars. Miss Vicky had called them utility vehicles and said they were a good choice for camping and rougher roads. The humans got out and looked around, the females wrinkling their noses like they had smelled a wheelbarrow of poop, which they couldn't have because Cougar hadn't buried much poop in the flower beds at the front of the house since he had been careful not to dig up the flowers Miss Vicky had planted. The humans were called Trina and Vaughn, and Darren and Pamela. They were staying in the main house with Miss Vicky. Herschel and Heidi were staying in the cabin next to Aggie's. The humans didn't say much while Miss Vicky did the registering thing, took the payment, and told Herschel and Heidi that she would walk down to the cabin with them and help them with the luggage because there wasn't a track to the cabins wide enough to accommodate anything bigger than a donkey cart, which she didn't have. Well, she had the cart, which was in pretty good shape. Conan had found it in the big shed with the tools, but not the donkey. No, she hadn't told Miss Vicky about the herd of donkeys that lived in the jumble. There had been no reason to say anything since the donkeys weren't Terra Indigene, and Miss Vicky hadn't said she wanted a donkey. She just explained to the guest humans that their cars wouldn't fit on the track to the cabins. They used the footpath between the main house and the cabins, since that was shorter than using the track. The Heidi human carried her own carry-all, but that Herschel gave the heaviest bag to Miss Vicky instead of carrying it himself. Once they reached the cabin and went inside, Miss Vicky returned to the house, intending to bring the guests a basket of fruit and treats, since Darren and Pamela had gone down to the cabin as soon as they dropped off their luggage in their suite. And Miss Vicky did bring the fruit and treats, but when she got back to the cabin, she heard the four humans talking, and...
"And?" Ilya Sanguinati said.
"What did they say?"
"They said Miss Vicky was as pathetic as they'd heard, and they were going to say so in their reviews. And the jumble wasn't rustic or quaint. It was decrepit and wouldn't amount to anything. And these were the cabins she claimed were renovated, when it was clear to anyone who bothered to look that she'd barely done anything at all. And then that Pamela said..."
Light feathers sprouted from Aggie's arms and smaller feathers framed her face as she remembered the wounded look in Miss Vicky's eyes.
"She said Miss Vicky should hire someone presentable to deal with guests because no one with any social standing would want to deal with a person who looked like she'd been dragged through a bush backwards."
"Miss Pamela female is the one who said that?"
Ilya asked mildly. Aggie rounded on him, forgetting caution in her desire to remind him that Miss Vicky had been the first human to act as reader in the jumble for a long, long time, and she was nice, and... When she looked at him, she realized Ilya's mild voice hid the same burning fury that she felt.
"Yes, she said that,"
Ilya thought for a moment. Humans say unkind things about each other all the time when the person being pecked with words isn't around to hear.
They knew she was there. Eddie Krogard heard them talking before Miss Vicky came back to the cabins with the treats. They were waiting for her, watching, so they would be sure she heard them.
I see. She was certain that he did see, and whatever happened to these humans would be a reflection of that seeing. Aggie hesitated, but if the Sanguinati were going to take vengeful payment for the humans being mean, she should mention the one human who hadn't been mean.
The Heidi human. After Miss Vicky left the treats and went back to her nest to cry, Heidi said that maybe they shouldn't have let Miss Vicky believe that they were reviewers from important travel magazines who were here incognito to tell other humans about the jumble. But even her mate said she was being soft-hearted or soft-headed. And the sooner Miss Vicky was out of the way, the sooner their own deal could go through.
Ilya stared at her. Out of the way? Is that the exact phrase they used? She nodded. They said nothing for several minutes, just stared at the other side of the lake. Finally, Ilya stirred. Who among the Krogard here can take a human form well enough to pass for human? The answer was simple, but Aggie thought about it, trying to figure out why he would want to know.
Besides me?
Clara? Eddie? Josie?
Eddie and Josie are closer to your age, yes?
Yes. Why?
They are going to stay at the cabin with you. The three of you rented the cabin for the entire summer. The girls sleep in the bed, and Eddie sleeps on the sofa.
But Miss Vicky didn't rent it to three of us, Aggie protested. We all decided that I would be the lodger.
The Krogard had discussed it and squabbled over it and finally voted on it. And she'd been so proud to be the one the rest of the crows had selected for this important first contact with the human who had been working to repair the jumble. Ilya rose from his chair. Aggie tried not to flinch. In crow form, she could fly fast, but the Sanguinati, in smoke form, could move even faster, could wrap around their prey and draw blood through the prey's skin. In human form, she didn't stand a chance against him. Then again, neither did humans.
You need to stay close to Miss Vicky and help her, and report to me everything the humans do and say around her.
But these are dangerous humans, Aggie, and a lone crow is vulnerable. I don't want you to be alone with those humans living so close.
My kin live all around the jumble.
But not seen, or not understood for what they are. Three Krogard in human form staying in a cabin? Better odds. Knowing there is a young male present, one who claims kinship to you, will discourage the males from being inappropriate.
Who is going to stop them from being inappropriate with Miss Vicky?
Aggie asked. Ilya smiled, showing his fangs.
I will.
It wasn't until she was flying back to the jumble that she remembered that, in the thriller books she liked to read, out of the way usually meant dead. Ilya watched the crow fly across the lake as he considered the information she had provided. Humans arriving at the jumble under false pretenses, using words to open wounds. They knew each other, had come here as a pack, had come incognito.
Problem?
Ilya glanced at Boris, who usually filled the role of chauffeur, insisting that a human who had a driver had more status than one who drove himself. Ilya wasn't sure that was true, but driving the car pleased Boris, so Ilya didn't argue about it. Besides, a chauffeur was considered to be in a different social class than an attorney, making it easier for Boris to talk to shopkeepers and flirt with, and feed on, the women who worked at the diner or the pizza shack. Of course, feeding in Sproing might be more difficult now that the Sanguinati had taken over the bank, forcing the citizens to acknowledge their presence. All the more reason to protect the places that provided shelter for transient humans, like the Jumble and Inike Xavier's boarding house.
Yes, there is a problem, Ilya replied. The guests used words to harm Victoria, told lies to make her think they are something they are not.
Easy enough to eliminate problems, Boris said blandly.
The thought of how to eliminate those problems made him hungry, so he pushed it aside, with regret.
Killing the first guests at the Jumble would not encourage other humans to visit.
It might. If we started a rumor that one of the cabins was haunted, we could even assist with the props. A chair that rocked on its own, a radio that turned on by itself, a blank pad of paper that had the beginning of a note written on the first page the next time a human walked by. Easy enough for one of us to do.
Ilya huffed out a laugh.
We'll save that possibility.
He sobered quickly, his anger returning full force.
For now, we need to know who these humans really are and where they're from. We need to know if they're the danger Julian Farrow sensed closing in on Victoria, or if these humans are like Detective Swin and his men. Are they more hounds to chase and harry? Or are they the hunters, the real threat to Victoria?
I could fetch the car, Boris said. We could drive over and pay a call.
No, I don't want to announce our connection to the Jumble. Not yet.
His lips curved in a savage smile.
But that doesn't mean we can't cross the lake and wait for an opportunity to find out more about Victoria's guests.
Chapter 44. Vicky. Moonsday. Sumer 3.
If these are the kind of people I'll have to deal with on a regular basis, I don't think I'm cut out for this business, I told Inike, as I sat in her kitchen, instead of running the errands I had told my guests I needed to run.
The truth? I hadn't needed to run errands first thing that morning. I had needed to run away from my guests.
They're checking out tomorrow morning, so you're almost done with them. You can hang on for one more day.
Inike pushed a plate of double fudge brownies closer to me.
Eat a few of these. You might end up in a chocolate coma and not wake up until it's time for them to check out.
I agreed to pick up pastries and other appropriate breakfast foods, since I can't be bothered with serving meals, which is what I should be doing if I want to keep up the pretense that the Jumble is a vacation spot.
Is that a direct quote?
Close enough. I reached for a brownie. Then I thought about the helpful pointers that had been made for the past 3 days every time I saw one of my guests. Well, screw them. If I was already a ginormous, slovenly glutton with a permanent bad hair day, I might as well stuff my face with food because, with my lack of looks, style, or fashion sense, a man who wasn't desperate wouldn't give me the time of day, let alone a screw. As if I wanted one. Yorick had cured me of that little fantasy. And now I knew the only good romantic sex was found in romance books. I bit into the brownie and chewed furiously, struggling against the tears stinging my eyes. Then I noticed the way Inike stared at me. I swallowed, forcing the bite of brownie down a tight throat. How much of that did I say out loud? I never found out how much I'd said, because Dominique and Maxwell walked into the kitchen from outdoors at the same moment Paige slammed into the kitchen, a plate full of food held between her shaking hands.
He said the eggs are cold and rubbery. He told me to take his plate away, and he would make do with something else. Then he said...
She choked, and would have dropped the plate if Dominique hadn't grabbed it and set it on the table.
He said he wouldn't mention the eggs or the inferior service he'd received so far if I was nice to him, and then he...
Sweetie, he's a terrible person, Dominique said,
guiding Paige to a chair.
We agreed yesterday that you shouldn't go in by yourself if he was the only one in the dining room.
She looked at me.
Grabby hands.
I didn't remember setting the brownie down, but I wasn't holding it when I pushed away from the table.
That's awful! Inike!
I stopped and watched Inike calmly remove a large pair of shears from one of the kitchen drawers.
Would you like to come with me while I explain a few things to Mr. and Mrs. Daniel Yates?
I didn't know what to do about my own guests. They weren't attacking anyone but me, after all, and words weren't a weapon you could report to the police. But I would stand with Inike to put a stop to her girls being harassed by someone who probably would argue that grabbing a girl's ass was a form of flirtation, and the girl was overreacting and just trying to stir up trouble. Inike and I walked into the dining room, followed by Maxwell, who whined because he knew something was very wrong with his family, but didn't know what to do.
Mr. Yates,
Inike said, at the same time a thin, dark-haired woman who looked like she would kill for a candy bar pushed past us and entered the dining room. I recognized her. I recognized him, too, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed man who had more of a paunch than he'd been carrying a few months ago.
Oh, gods, you have got to be kidding.
I turned to Inike.
That isn't Daniel Yates. That's my ex-husband, York Dane, the second Mrs. Dane, and the vigorous appendage.
Shit,
Inike snarled. Maxwell zipped around the room, then started talking to us in that growly, barky, yip-yip way he used when conversing with humans, clearly wanting some kind of answer.
Can't you shut that thing up?
Mrs. Dane said, further endearing herself to the whole Xavier family.
Vicky named three, and he could only find two,
Inike said. Well, if that's what Maxwell is asking about. I pointed at York's crotch and said very loudly,
that's where Mr. Grabby Hands is hiding the vigorous appendage.
Chapter 45 Grimshaw Moonsday, Sumer 3
Dressing for work and wondering what Inike was serving for breakfast, Grimshaw suddenly cocked his head, his khaki short-sleeved shirt dangling from his fingers, and listened to voices loud enough to penetrate the door to his room on the second floor. Male and female, punctuated by Maxwell barking. When he heard the piercing scream, Grimshaw dropped his shirt, grabbed his service weapon, and rushed out of his room, colliding with Osgood. The baby cop wore nothing but a pair of cutoffs and still had beads of water on his chest from the shower, but he also had his weapon. They ran down the stairs and followed the screams. Easy enough to see the action was in the dining room, but getting to it might be a problem. Vicky Devine was trying to hold on to Maxwell, telling him it was all right that Mr. Grabby Hands hadn't eaten the vigorous appendage. He'd just hidden it. The woman he couldn't see but could hear yelling for someone to call an ambulance had to be Mrs. Yates, one of the new guests. And Inike,
what were you planning to do with the shears, Inike?
He asked. She turned toward him, a murderous look in her dark eyes. She raised the shears and focused on them. Open, close, open, close.
Nothing,
she said, with a smile that made Grimshaw's balls shrink and sweat trickle down his spine.
Maxwell took care of it.
Somebody call an ambulance,
Mrs. Yates screamed. Grimshaw held out his left hand, reluctant to move too close to Inike. She stared at him a moment too long before offering the shears. He quickly handed them off to Osgood and stepped into the dining room, putting the safety on before tucking his gun into the waistband of his trousers. Mr. Yates was on the floor, holding his crotch and screaming, more like whimpering now. Then he saw Grimshaw and yelled,
"That fucking dog attacked me! Shoot it!"
"Don't be so melodramatic, Yorick," Vicky snapped.
"Maxwell didn't attack you. He was trying to rescue the vigorous appendage.
She rubbed the border collie's head.
Weren't you, Maxwell? You just wanted to rescue the wiggly duckling from the grabby man.
Oh, gods. Then, grabby man? Yorick? That wasn't the name he'd been given when they'd all had dinner here last night. He thought about Vicky's words and the look in Inike's eyes, and the way Paige had gone quiet at some point during the weekend. No flirting with Osgood. No teasing him. Not even a smile. As if she didn't want to be noticed.
Miss Devine, would you take Maxwell into the kitchen and wait for me there?
He asked.
I really should be going. I'm supposed to.
He gave her the don't mess with me stare. Vicky stared back, her defiance lasting longer than he'd expected. Then she nodded.
We'll wait for you in the kitchen. You too, Miss Xavier.
Inike left the dining room without a word in protest, and that worried him. He took the shears from Osgood and said quietly,
talk to Paige and Dominic. See if you can coax them into telling you what's going on.
Finally, he turned to the Yateses, or more correctly, Mr. and Mrs. Dane. Yorick Dane had managed to get off the floor and collapse into a chair.
You want to tell me what happened?
The wording sounded friendly, as if they had a choice.
That beast attacked me, Dane said. It's a danger to people and should be shot.
Well, Maxwell is protective of his people.
It's the fault of Vicky Devine, Mrs. Dane said. She's the one who riled up the beast to attack my husband out of spite and jealousy, just because we're going to...
Constance.
The word came out breathy, but Grimshaw heard the warning in Dane's voice.
What are you doing in Sproing?
He asked.
We wanted to get away from the city, Mrs. Dane said.
There are resorts on the lakes closer to Hubney.
Why here? He kept his voice friendly.
I have property here, Dane said. You had property here, Grimshaw corrected. Unless you've purchased something the residents haven't heard about yet, which is unlikely. The only property that had formerly belonged to the Dane family is the Jumble, and that now belongs to Vicky Devine.
It still belongs to the Dane family, since Vicky didn't fulfill the terms of the agreement,
Dane corrected in turn.
But I had hoped to discuss this with her quietly, like adults, avoid embarrassing her in front of her neighbors, since I'm sure she didn't make anyone privy to the arrangement.
Except her attorney.
Grimshaw smiled. I'm sure he's reviewed all the documents that pertain to transfer of ownership. Dane went pale. Or paler, since he hadn't regained any color yet.
Didn't know about the attorney, did you?
Which means you probably don't know who represents Miss Victoria Devine.
I'll contact Dr. Wallace and ask him to make a house call. I want that woman charged with assault, Dane snapped.
Grimshaw nodded.
Assault with a border collie. Not something I put in a report every day.
You think this is funny?
Mrs. Dane demanded.
No, I never think assault is funny. Which is why I will write up the report against Miss Xavier. Just as soon as I determine if I'm also writing up a report against Mr. Dane for sexual assault.
He walked out of the dining room, leaving them sputtering. Chapter 46. Vicky. Moonsday, Sumer 3.
It was a stupid and impulsive thing to do, and it's my fault, so you can't blame poor Maxwell for trying to rescue a small critter, I said as soon as Officer Grimshaw walked into the kitchen. Even only wearing the khaki trousers and a white undershirt, he still looked intimidating and official. Especially now that I was having trouble holding on to my mad and intriguing because he also wore a round gold medal on a chain, a medal that looked like the one sold at the Universal Temples as an acknowledgement of a person's guardian spirit. Somehow, I hadn't thought of Grimshaw as a spiritual man. Yorick and I had attended the neighborhood Universal Temple
while we were married for the same reason we'd gone to parties or other social events that were attended by people he claimed to despise. To be seen, so that another checkmark would be made in the proper column. He'd scoffed at having any material reminder of the gods and guardian spirits who were supposed to watch over humans. I should ask Inike if there was a guardian spirit who looked out for innkeepers of all sorts, including caretakers of Terra Indigene settlements. Grimshaw didn't respond to my opening confession. He just stared out the kitchen door to where Osgood and Paige were slowly walking across the lawn to a bench under one of the big maple trees. Then he sat at the table and leaned toward Inike.
"Does Paige need to see a doctor?"
he asked. He looked at Dominique, who was standing at the counter.
"Do you?"
Dominique shook her head, and Inike said, "If either of them had needed a doctor because of him, he wouldn't have been curled up on my floor like a cooked shrimp." She didn't say what would have happened, but I didn't think Grimshaw had forgotten about the "I bury trouble" tattoo on her thigh. I sure hadn't. Maybe I didn't want to ask Inike about the compost she used in her kitchen garden to make the vegetables grow so well. "Do you want some breakfast, Officer Grimshaw?" Dominique asked. He shook his head.
"Just coffee if it's convenient."
She poured him a cup, then went outside to join Paige and Osgood.
"What happened?"
He held up a hand.
"Not just now in the dining room. What has happened since the Danes arrived using an alias? And damn it, Inike, you have two cops in the house. Why didn't you say something about Danes' behavior?"
Inike shrugged. "We've dealt with men like him before." I thought about the vacations York and I had taken. I thought about the look on the faces of the young women who had worked in the hotels or resorts. I thought about how I believed for so long that there was no connection between the poor service we received and the way those women looked at him, and the blend of pity and resentment aimed at me. "If I'd known your guest was York, I would have warned you," I said quietly.
"I know," Inike replied. Then she smiled. "I don't think Mr. Dane was prepared to get headbutted by Maxwell, or have him try to dig through the pants to reach the wiggly. I think it was when Maxwell got his teeth around the zipper, and maybe a bit more that..."
"Stop," Grimshaw said.
I'd forgotten about him, which wasn't easy to do since he was sitting right there, although he did look a wee bit green.
"If Dane presses charges, you'll press charges, and if he drops the assault charges, you'll do the same?"
Inike studied him.
"Are you asking or telling?"
"Asking."
"I won't file an official complaint against him, as long as he does the same."
After living and sproing these past few months, I knew what that meant. Inike didn't have to file an official complaint because, by now, all the people who worked in service businesses had already heard about York's wandering hands and his view that there was nothing wrong with trying it on to see if "no" really meant "yes." Once word spread that Mr. Yates was actually one of the Danes, there wouldn't be a girl in the village York could even look at without a father or older brother blocking his view. Inike might be one of the odd Xaviers who ran a boarding house, but she had considerable influence within a certain segment of the village's population. And as Grimshaw had pointed out, she had the village's two cops rooming with her right now. And while I would never, ever, ever say this when there was any possibility of Grimshaw hearing me, it occurred to me that if I quietly pointed out York to the Sproingers, as well as the Crows, he wouldn't be able to sneak off to meet anyone for any reason without someone, or something, paying attention. Chapter 47. Grimshaw. Moonsday. Sumer 3. Grimshaw parked his cruiser in the space next to the black luxury sedan. He got out and nodded to the man standing in front of the sedan, wearing a chauffeur's hat. He knew Ilya Sanguinati usually had a driver, but this was the first time that individual was making a point of being seen. Was it a coincidence that the point was being made today? Or was it a deliberate message? The Sanguinati had controlled this village from behind the scenes for who knew how many generations. Now they weren't being subtle about the businesses and property they owned. Some of that might be due to the upheaval last summer, when someone somewhere had made the decision to show the humans living on the continent of Thasia that there were fewer human places than they had wanted to believe, and none of those places were safe. Here in Sproing, the trouble at the jumble and the pressure on Vicky Devine and the others' interest in her had been the tipping point when it came to the Sanguinati's decision to come out of the shadows. When the Terra Indigene not only controlled all the natural resources, but also openly controlled things like banks and commerce, arrogance was an indulgence humans could not afford. Which made whatever was going on here even more dangerous.
"Is Mr. Sanguinati in his office?"
Grimshaw asked the driver.
"He is?"
The vampire's voice was stiffly polite and offered nothing.
"Thanks."
Grimshaw opened the glass door that led to the second floor and went halfway up the stairs before he stopped and pulled out his mobile phone to make a call.
"Let us read." "Julian, it's Wayne. Can you close up for a few minutes?" "I'm not officially open yet. You're at the station?" "Going up to Ilya Sanguinati's office. I'd like your input."
He waited for Julian's usual protest about not being on the police force anymore.
"Does this have something to do with what I sensed when we played the murder game?" "I think so. I'll be right over."
Grimshaw waited at the top of the stairs. When Julian joined him, he knocked on the door that didn't have a company name before turning the knob and going in. The small receptionist's desk was bare of everything but a notepad, a pen, and a telephone. It looked old and ornate and in pristine condition, making Grimshaw wonder when the furnishings had been moved into this office, and how anyone had gotten the furniture up the narrow flight of stairs. Floor-to-ceiling bookcases created a partial wall that divided the reception area from what he assumed was a private office.
"Come in, gentlemen," Ilya Sanguinati said.
No surprise that Ilya had known who had entered his space. The Terra Indigene could communicate with one another over distances, and the driver would have told him who was climbing the stairs for a meeting. Grimshaw walked to the opening that served as a doorway and stopped, surprised at the lush plants that filled the credenza beneath the windows overlooking Main Street. The desk in this room was twice the size of the other, and was also an antique, but it had a monitor and keyboard on one side, and a telephone and trays for paperwork on the other side. Ilya Sanguinati looked up and blanked the screen on the monitor.
"Officer Grimshaw, Mr. Farrell, is there something I can do for you?"
Grimshaw settled in one of the visitor's chairs, while Julian took the other.
"York Dane is in town, staying at Inikay's."
Julian snapped to attention and swore quietly.
"I'm surprised she let him through the door," Ilya said.
"He used an alias. Vicky Devine identified him during a ruckus this morning. He and his wife aren't scheduled to check out until tomorrow, but I'm sure Inikay will want to toss him out as soon as Dr. Wallace examines him. I need your help to persuade her to let him stay for the rest of today."
"Why would I do that?"
Ilya asked, in a mild way that filled Grimshaw with dread.
"Yes, Wayne. Why let that man stay another hour?"
Julian asked, with an edge in his voice.
"According to Dane, his family still controls the jumble because Vicky didn't fulfill the terms of the agreement,"
Grimshaw replied, watching Ilya. Something cold and ugly moved in Ilya's eyes. A reminder that a taste for antiques and expensive clothes didn't change the fact that the Sanguinati were lethal predators.
"I read through all the paperwork with regard to the divorce settlement and Victoria's claim to the jumble," Ilya said. "There were no conditions to her receiving the jumble. No terms that needed to be fulfilled."
Grimshaw nodded.
"I figured as much. If everything was above board, Dane wouldn't have come here using a false name. Well,
It would have been hard for Dane to find a place to stay if he'd used his own name unless he wanted to rent one of the houses on High Street for a month, or stay in one of the run-down campers at the edge of town. Ilya hesitated, then handed Grimshaw a sheet of paper from a legal pad.
He isn't the only one who has come here under false pretenses. The humans staying at the jumble also gave aliases, and they're pretending to be reviewers for travel magazines. Also, they were overheard to say that Victoria had to be removed from the jumble before their own deal could go through.
How did you get these names?
Grimshaw looked up.
You didn't ask Aggie Krogard to go poking around in their rooms, did you?
Of course not. For one thing, crows can't get through the screens in the windows, something which is not an impediment to the sanguinati in our smoke form. I entered the suites in the main house, found the humans' identity cards, and memorized the names and addresses. My driver uncovered the real identities of the two humans who are staying in one of the renovated cabins.
What's the second reason you didn't ask the crows?
Julian asked. Ilya gave him an arch look.
I didn't want them to be tempted by the shinies scattered on the dressers. At least not while Victoria still has control of the jumble. If ownership should change hands.
His shoulders moved in a minute shrug. Grimshaw handed back the paper and pinched the bridge of his nose, as if that would relieve the headache building behind his eyes.
Any thoughts about what's really going on? Because I'm not buying Dane's claim that Vicky failed to meet part of the agreement, and the Dane family can reclaim the jumble by default.
Ilya sat back in his chair.
When I reviewed all the legal documents that dealt with Victoria's divorce and settlement, I found it interesting that the listed value of the house, automobile, and furnishings that York Dane retained was considerably less than the value of the jumble. Despite the automobile being fairly new, and the house needing nothing more than annual maintenance. The liquid assets were divided based on those assessments.
The jumble is a business venture made up of several buildings and acres of land, not to mention private access to the lake, Grimshaw said. It stands to reason it would be worth more than the residence. No one had put any work into those buildings in decades,
Julian countered.
That should have been taken into account by whoever had done the assessment.
Ilya smiled, showing a hint of fang.
A good point, Mr. Farrow. And one I believe was, in fact, taken into account.
Among the papers Franklin Cartwright had been carrying on the day he was killed were notes indicating that he had been in Sproing prior to the date when York Dane filed for divorce, and had made a careful assessment of the jumble's condition at that time, and what it would cost to turn the place into a Stage 1 income stream. The cash settlement to Victoria was sufficient for her to make all the major repairs to the main house, and at least some of the cabins. Perhaps all of the cabins. But she was practical about holding back the money she needed to live on during the months of renovation, and the time it would take to attract paying guests.
I don't remember the CIU team finding any paperwork near Cartwright's body,
Grimshaw said. He certainly hadn't seen any when he'd secured the scene and waited for the CIU boys to show up.
They didn't.
Ilya replied so pleasantly there was no question that the subject was closed. Meaning, whatever information the Sanguinati had would be shared when they wanted to share, and there was nothing the human police could do about it. Grimshaw frowned.
So Dane knew how much Vicky Devine would have to sink into the buildings to turn the jumble into a rustic resort because he had hired Franklin Cartwright to assess the property. And then he had Cartwright come back here to find out if she'd done enough work to make it worth his while to reclaim it? To reclaim it as a Stage 1 income stream,
Julian said.
Which means there is a Stage 2.
He stared at Ilya.
Did you find anything else in those papers Franklin Cartwright was carrying when he died?
A weighted silence. Then Ilya opened a drawer and removed a stack of papers. He unfolded one and turned it so that Grimshaw and Julian could see it. A map of the jumble. But not the jumble as it was today. Not a rustic resort. This was a luxury resort. And that made no sense.
Mr. Paperhead, Julian whispered.
His hand clamped on Grimshaw's wrist.
Inike, Vicky, Paige, Dominic, all in danger. That was Vicky's dream.
By itself, Vicky's dream had been nothing more than a weird dream, a concoction of images her subconscious had burped into her sleep. He'd taken down the details to appease the others, and, all right, to be a hard-ass about being called to the jumble because of a dream. But for him, it had been Julian's response to the dream that had given weight to the whole thing then. And now. 8 people arrive in Sproing at the same time, using false names, Ilya said. 6 of them know each other. It stands to reason they also know York Dane, since one of them referred to a deal involving the jumble.
Grimshaw nodded. Odds are building a luxury resort would require investors, and those people would want to take a look at their property. Dane couldn't have stayed with them at the jumble, even under an assumed name. Vicky recognized him as soon as she saw him.
But was that the only reason Dane had stayed at the boarding house? Or was he scouting? As Julian had pointed out when they'd sat in Inike's parlor the other day discussing the dream, Inike and Vicky owned the 2 properties around Sproing that accommodated travelers. Still, when he considered all the potential people involved in Dane's attempt to reclaim the jumble, it just didn't add up.
Is the jumble as it is now really a lucrative enough business for a group of people to conspire to take it from Vicky Devine? Grimshaw asked. I've heard that fishermen lust for a chance to fish in Mill Creek, but the best runs aren't on easily accessible or safe land. Julian replied. It may be seasonal, but I can see Vicky's creekside cabins providing a nice income, even in their primitive state, as long as permission to fish in the creek was part of the rental agreement. And the cabins near the lake would make some money, too. Julian shrugged. I think an individual could make a living from renting the cabins, but the only way I can see for a group of investors to make enough would be to develop the land.
Which still belongs to the Terra Indigene, Ilya said. The Dane family owned the buildings, and only as long as they abided by the terms of the original agreement. They never controlled any part of the land.
Does York Dane know that? Julian asked.
Ilya looked surprised.
How could he not know? He supplied a copy of the original agreement with the rest of the papers Victoria received with regard to the divorce settlement.
He waved a hand at the map. This luxury resort will never be built.
Because the moment someone digs up a spade of earth for something other than a flower bed or garden, people are going to die, Grimshaw thought. If the people staying at the jumble are investors in this scheme of Dane's, I wonder if he's told any of them about the original agreement and the building restrictions, Julian said. After all, he finagled the divorce settlement so that it looked like he was being fair. Why be truthful with potential investors? And if they all belong to the Tie Clip Club? Grimshaw asked. Then someone believes, in the face of all reason, that they can build this thing without the Terra Energy noticing. It's a kind of willful blindness that occurs most often in humans who live in human-controlled cities. Some people still believe they can make the others disappear, simply by insisting that everything that lives in the wild country doesn't exist.
Enough, Ilya said. We have stripped the meat from the bone, and there is nothing left but gristle. Grimshaw had to agree. Outside of giving false names, the people staying at the jumble hadn't done anything wrong. At least, nothing that had been reported to the police.
I'll see what I can find out about Vicky's guests.
Inquiries are already being made about them, but your sources may have access to different information. Ilya tore a sheet of paper off a legal pad and copied the names and addresses he'd found. He handed the sheet to Grimshaw.
If I find out anything useful, I'll let you know.
Grimshaw stood and folded the paper until it fit into a pocket.
Are you going to ask Vicky Devine to leave the jumble?
Instead of answering, Ilya looked at Julian, who stared out the window behind Ilya's desk.
The village is all stirred up and doesn't feel comfortable, but I'm not sensing physical danger within the village boundaries,
Julian said slowly.
I don't think the real danger has arrived yet, so Vicky doesn't have to leave the jumble today.
He thought for a moment.
But soon. Soon.
When that time comes, I'll get her away from the jumble,
Ilya said, standing up to indicate the discussion was finished. Grimshaw didn't offer his hand. Neither did Julian. They left the office and walked down the stairs, but stood just inside the glass door at street level.
This was a setup from the start,
Julian said, staring at the street.
Yep.
And so far, Yorick Dane's scheme had been indirectly responsible for the deaths of 4 men. He needed to apprise Captain Hargreaves that there was a serious situation brewing around Sproing. As they stepped outside, Grimshaw heard the phone ringing in the police station. When it kept ringing, he hurried to unlock the door. It stopped ringing the moment he walked inside, but his mobile phone started.
Grimshaw?
Sir, are you there?
Osgood didn't sound steady.
He didn't point out to the baby cop that, since he answered his own phone, he was there.
Problem?
There's a situation at the jumble.
What kind of situation?
I guess you would call it vandalism, or threatening behavior.
He looked at Julian, who gave him the I'm not a cop anymore look in return. But he couldn't count on Osgood if he had to deal with any of the furred or feathered residents at the jumble. Not yet, anyway.
What exactly?
He asked.
Something opened a back window on one of the cars and peed, well, sprayed a lot of urine on the seats, and one of the cars was flipped over on its roof.
That's the vandalism. What's the threatening behavior?
Unspecified.
Are you still at the boarding house?
Yes, sir.
Is Vicky Devine?
Yes.
Then let her know I'm going out to investigate. Tell her to stay in town until I give the all clear. You got that?
She'll be concerned about her guests.
Then you take her car keys and try to impress on Inike that Vicky should stay with her.
Yes, sir.
Julian didn't say a thing. He got in the cruiser on the passenger side before Grimshaw opened the driver's side door.
You're not a cop anymore, I know.
He looked at his friend.
But this is a bit of Yahoo Frontier law at this point.
Not that Highway Patrol didn't always have a bit of Yahoo Frontier law. Not that Highway Patrol officers didn't walk into dangerous situations before backup could reach them. But screwing up in the wild country usually meant a single life at risk, not a chain reaction that could lead to an entire village disappearing if he lost control of the situation.
I want to take a look at these guests,
Julian said.
I want to know if the feel of the jumble has changed because of them, for all our sakes.
Grimshaw pulled out of the parking space, turned on his lights, and headed for the jumble. Chapter 48. Vicky. Moonsday. Sumer 3. Poor Osgood. He never stood a chance. If he'd come in like Grimshaw would have done, all official and imposing, held out his hand, and told me to hand over my car keys, I would have been sufficiently intimidated to do exactly that. But despite being dressed in his uniform, Osgood had radiated nerves when he asked for my keys. Nerves made him a regular person instead of an official police person. So I, quite reasonably, asked him why he needed the keys. And Paige asked if there was something wrong with his car that he needed to borrow mine. By that time, Inike had realized something was a trifle off and flanked him. The three of us and Osgood in the middle. It made me think of a nature show I'd watched last year about a pride of lions in Africa. The little critter caught by the lionesses
hadn't stood a chance either. A pride of lions. A pride of Xavier's. Would Inike find humor in the comparison? Maybe it was something Julian Farrow would appreciate. Or not. In short order, we knew why Osgood wanted the keys, where Grimshaw had gone, and that there was some kind of disagreement between the guests and the Jumble's residents. It took a few minutes more to fully appreciate that Osgood was so freshly out of the police academy that coming to Sproing with Detective Oilslick Swin and the rest of that team, and encountering the Terra Indigene who killed some of those men, was his first assignment. So while he had the academy training for what to do with lawbreakers and ordinary people things, he didn't have any on-the-job training yet that would help him cope with the elders, or with women like the Xaviers. All to my advantage. Since we didn't want Osgood to get into trouble with Grimshaw, who was his boss, at least for the short term, I gave him my car keys, which were what he'd been told to acquire. Then Inike and I packed up what food she could spare, ran out to her car, which did not fall under Osgood's orders, and drove to the Jumble, leaving Paige to handle Osgood, which wouldn't be hard if she fibbed a little and told him that Dominique and Maxwell were out and she felt uneasy about being at the boarding house alone while York was still there. And couldn't Osgood stay until Inike got back? When do you think Osgood will realize Paige wouldn't have been alone? I asked. She would have been, Inike replied, making a sharp turn. Dominique took Maxwell for a walk, so he wouldn't spend the whole day standing in front of the Dane's bedroom door, growling. Do you think he'll forget about the vigorous appendage by the time he gets back from the walk? He's a border collie. He doesn't forget anything he can possibly heard. Well, that should shorten York's visit. Inike suddenly looked grim. Don't count on it. When we reached the Jumble, I didn't recognize the young man who unhooked the chain across the access road, but he had the look of one of the Crow Guard. I'm Eddie, he said, as we rolled slowly past him. I'm helping Aggie and Josie, and the Sanguinati. Helping them with what? Grimshaw's cruiser was parked in front of the main house, as far from the three utility vehicles as he could manage and still turn around without hitting a tree. The UV in the middle looked untouched. The one I approached after getting out of Inike's car had an open back window and... I clapped both hands over my nose and mouth, while Inike said, "Gods above and below, that's a stink!" Maybe human pee smelled just as bad to Cougar, or whatever had sprayed an opinion into the interior of the UV. But the vehicle smelled like a well-used litter box without the litter. The third UV, which was a greenish-brown, looked like a rubber-footed turtle that had been flipped on its back. I decided right then and there that she who lives in the Jumble should never, ever, ever think too long or too hard about the large beings that also lived in the Jumble, because thinking about them being out there would lead to anxiety attacks and an inability to go outside. Even though we arrived bringing brunch and lunch, Grimshaw wasn't happy to see us. And Julian looked wary, although he tried to hide it. My guests weren't trying to hide anything. Four of them were expressing themselves at full volume about the lack of service, about their being threatened, about damage to property. Trina wasn't in the hall. Heidi was, and she was trying to say something, but I couldn't hear her.
Enough!
Conan roared as he walked down the stairs. I agree. I turned toward the front door. When had Ilya Sanguinati arrived, and how much had he heard?
Who are you?
Vaughn demanded.
Miss Devine's attorney.
Ilya walked in and stood beside me. Vaughn gave me a cold look.
You're going to need one.
I'll put the food in the fridge, Inike murmured. She took the bags of food and headed for the kitchen. Wondering what else she planned to do once she was out of Grimshaw's sight, and wishing I could go with her, I resigned myself to enduring extreme unpleasantness.
The rental agreement did have a separate clause guests had to sign that said I wasn't responsible for any damage to their property during their stay. But I was reluctant to point that out, since I was pretty sure the men would start hollering again. And men hollering tended to trigger anxiety attacks.
What provoked them?
Ilya asked, directing the question to Conan. Grimshaw didn't growl about someone else's asking questions, so either he hadn't gotten any answers that he believed from the humans, or he wanted to hear the other's version of events, and hadn't had a chance to ask before Inike and I arrived, or hadn't been successful in getting any of my lodger employees to talk to him. Conan pointed at Darren and Pamela.
Aggie and Josie found these two humans in Miss Vicky's private den, going through her belongings. When Aggie told them to leave, they refused and said, "Insults," before I came up and helped the crow guard drive them from the den.
The perverse part of me wanted to hear what they had said, even knowing I would be hurt by it. The tiny part of me that was an enthusiastic supporter of self-preservation understood that, while Conan would tell Ilya at some point, and might even tell Grimshaw, exactly what was said, the bear had already decided not to tell me.
"He manhandled me,"
Pamela said, her voice shrill as she showed everyone the torn pockets in her capris.
"And he threatened Darren."
"Threatened to disembowel me," Darren said.
"Did they take anything?"
Ilya asked Conan, ignoring the humans.
"They tried," Conan replied. "But they did not leave with anything that did not belong to them."
Hopefully, they also didn't leave anything in my suite, like intestines. Not likely, since Darren was waving his arms and down here with the rest of his friends. But I really liked the carpet I had put in my bedroom, and didn't want it stained by people innards.
"Herschel was in our cabin, resting, and I was in the library looking for a book to read,"
Heidi volunteered, sounding anxious to establish the legitimacy of their activities.
"You did say we could borrow a book while we were here."
I wasn't the only one who saw the disgusted looks Pamela, Vaughn, and Darren gave her, and I felt sorry for Heidi. She was older than the other two women, and even rounder than me, so she probably endured a bushel of verbal cuts whenever she and her husband socialized with the other two couples. She actually seemed like a nice person, much nicer than her husband, which must have made her the odd man out even in her own home. I could relate to that. I could also relate to her husband looking at her as if she had farted at the moment he introduced her to an important client.
"And the female who was missing?" Ilya asked.
"Where was she?"
"Trina isn't well," Vaughn said. "She had some kind of dizzy spell. I was going to take her to the doctor. Then we discovered the vandalism."
"Where was she when she had this dizzy spell?"
Ilya was using his scary, mild voice. A woman walked into the hallway and said,
"She had picked the lock on Miss Devine's office, but she couldn't go through the files or take anything because I was there."
She smiled at me. She wasn't beautiful, at least by current standards, but her face was arresting, and she looked great in the sharply tailored black business suit. And with the long black hair, dark eyes, and olive-toned skin, she was definitely Sanguinati.
"What was she doing in there?"
Vaughn demanded.
"And how did my wife end up having a dizzy spell just by being in that room? Is this place contaminated with mold or something else perilous to human health?"
"Definitely something else." Was Vaughn the only one who hadn't figured that out? Sanguinati plus intruder equals lunch.
"I am the CPA," she said, managing to imply in those three words that she had been in my office because she was my CPA.
Since I hadn't seen her before, I hope no one asked me to introduce her.
"Miss Devine," she said, "since you weren't involved in this incident, perhaps I could have a few minutes now to review the accounts?"
Grimshaw immediately focused on her.
"I might have some questions, Miss
Natasha Sanguinati."
They all looked at Natasha.
They all looked at Ilya. At least some of my guests were beginning to figure things out. Or not. Or maybe they counted on nothing happening to them while Grimshaw was there upholding the law. I wasn't sure how much law he could uphold, but his presence seemed like the assurance they all needed to continue to yap at the Sanguinati. The lightest touch of Ilya's hand